Knowledge Products presents The Giants of Philosophy, Soren Kierkegaard, narrated by Charlton Heston, Part 9.
Now we have before us the basic thoughts behind Kierkegaard's attack on the Danish Lutheran Church. This attack consumed the final year of his life. Its essentials had been thoroughly laid out in his work Practice in Christianity, published in 1850, and in For Self-Examination, released the following year. But Kierkegaard bided his time till 1854, when he began his all-out attack on the church. He used the intervening years to fill his journals with ammunition. His reason for waiting appears to be linked to his heartfelt yet disappointed devotion to Bishop Minster. Kierkegaard explains his delay in a journal entry from March 1, 1854, the day Minster died.
Now he is dead. It would have been most desirable if he could have been persuaded to end his life by confessing to Christianity that what he represented was not really Christianity, but a milder form of it. For he supported a whole generation. The possibility of this confession had therefore to be held open to the end, to the very last moment. Perhaps he might have wished to make it on his deathbed. That is why he could never be attacked, and I had to stand everything. Now that he is dead without having made it, everything is changed. All that is left is that by his preaching he has hardened Christianity into a deception. And everything is changed in my melancholy devotion to my dead father's pastor. For it would be too much if even after his death I could not speak more freely of him.
Kierkegaard showed no such reluctance to publicly denounce the new Bishop of Zealand, H.L. Martensen. Kierkegaard had studied under Martensen at the university, and even at that time there was tension between them. But it was Martensen's memorial sermon over Minster that touched off Kierkegaard's battle with the church. On December 18, 1854, the following article appeared in the newspaper The Fatherland.
In the address which Professor Martensen delivered on the fifth Sunday after Epiphany, the Sunday preceding the burial of Bishop Minster, a speech of remembrance, it might be called, for the reason that it brought to Professor Martensen's remembrance the vacant episcopal see. In this address, Bishop Minster is represented as one of the genuine witnesses to the truth. With the figure of the deceased bishop before our eyes, we are exhorted to imitate the faith of the true guide, the genuine witness to the truth, to imitate his faith, for that, as was said expressly of Bishop Minster, was shown not merely by word and profession, but in deed and in truth. The deceased bishop is, by Professor Martensen, introduced into the holy chain of witnesses to the truth, which stretches through the ages from the days of the apostles. Against this, I must protest.
If Martensen wanted to beat Kierkegaard, he couldn't have picked a better phrase than witness for the truth. Kierkegaard had thought and written much about those who witness for the truth, and he'd consciously limited the phrase to those who suffer martyrdom for the truth.
A witness to the truth is a man whose life from first to last is unacquainted with everything which is called enjoyment. A witness to the truth is a man who in poverty witnesses to the truth. In poverty, in loneliness, in abasement, and so is unappreciated, hated, abhorred, and then derided, insulted, mocked. His daily bread perhaps he did not always have, so poor was he, but the daily bread of persecution he was richly provided with every day. A witness to the truth is a man who is scourged, maltreated, dragged from one prison to the other, and then, at last, the last promotion, whereby he is admitted into the first class as defined by the Christian protocol, among the genuine witnesses to the truth. Then, at last, crucified, or beheaded, or burnt, or roasted on a gridiron, his lifeless body thrown by the executioner in an out-of-the-way place.
But far from suffering for the truth, Minster had done rather well for himself as bishop. He lived in a palatial residence associated with the elite of society and received public acclaim for his preaching. What's more, all mention of truly religious suffering was conspicuously absent from his sermons.
Bishop Minster's preaching soft-pedals, slurs over, suppresses, omits something decisively Christian, something which appears to us men inopportune, which would make our life strenuous, hinder us from enjoying life. That part of Christianity which has to do with dying from the world, by voluntary renunciation, by hating oneself, by suffering for the doctrine. So when alongside of it one lays the New Testament, Bishop Minster's proclamation of Christianity was a very questionable sort of preaching, especially on the part of one who was a witness to the truth.
Martinson, already by this time invested as bishop, quickly responded in another Copenhagen newspaper. He said Kierkegaard's tirade confused a witness to the truth with a blood witness. Kierkegaard immediately replied he'd not been confused. He simply concluded from the essential teaching of Christianity that God's kingdom is not of this world. He said to live truly as a Christian, to witness to the truth, is to place oneself at odds with the powers and principalities that rule this world.
The term witness to the truth stands in relation to the fact that Christianity is heterogeneous to the world. Wherefore, witness must always be recognizable by heterogeneity to this world, by renunciation, by suffering.
Is Kierkegaard complaining because Minster, Martinson, and the rest of the Danish clergy live comfortable, easy lives instead of martyring themselves? By no means. Kierkegaard pronounces himself ready to support pay raises for the clergy to make things easier yet. What then does he want? Kierkegaard answers this question in an article published in March of 1855.
What do I want? Quite simply, I want honesty. I am not for Christian severity as opposed to Christian leniency. I am for human honesty. But one thing I will not do, not for anything in the world, I will not, by suppression or by performing tricks, try to produce the impression that the ordinary Christianity in the land and the Christianity of the New Testament are alike.
But it's just this pretense that the clergy of the country are perpetrating.
So soon as it is said that a priest is at the same time a witness to the truth, that very instant the established church is, Christianly understood, an impudent indecency. With this assertion, the established church can no longer be regarded as an extreme instance of leniency, which nevertheless is related to the Christianity of the New Testament. But it is openly an apostasy from the Christianity of the New Testament. With this assertion, it is Christianly an impudent indecency, an effort in the direction of making a fool of God.
His conviction that the established church is guilty of this impudent indecency leads Kierkegaard to make an extraordinary appeal.
Whoever thou art, whatever in other respects thy life may be, my friend, by ceasing to take part in the public worship of God as it now is, with the claim that it is the Christianity of the New Testament, thou hast constantly one guilt less, and that a great one. Thou dost not take part in treating God as a fool.
In the United States, we have no established state church like the Danish Lutheran Church that Kierkegaard attacked. But we can be sure that Kierkegaard would be just as critical of the church in America, wherever it's part of the cultural establishment, wherever it caters to our self-satisfied complacency. But it's important to note that Kierkegaard's criticism of Christianity is fundamentally different from the criticisms of later existentialists like Nietzsche and Sartre. Kierkegaard criticizes Christianity not for its principles, but for its failure to take those principles seriously. In all, Kierkegaard placed 21 polemical articles in the Fatherland. When the editors refused to print more, he published 9 issues of his own magazine, The Instant. The Instant contained nothing other than his own attacks on the official Christianity of Denmark. Shortly before publishing the 10th issue, and immediately after withdrawing the last of the inheritance from his father, Kierkegaard collapsed in the street. He was taken to Friedrichs Hospital, refusing communion and all other ministrations of the clergy. He died there 6 weeks later, on November 11, 1855. He was 42 years old. In spite of his age, Kierkegaard was very much an old man. His body, weak and sickly since his youth, was simply worn out by intense thought and writing. And he'd said his piece. The attack on the church was the natural conclusion of Kierkegaard's long educational project. He'd begun 13 years earlier with Either Or. That effort ended on a bitter note, but his work reawakened a vivid sense of what it is to exist as a human being, and especially what it is to exist as a follower of Christ. This project is nowhere better summed up than in the clearly retrospective preface to his book, For Self-Examination. He wrote it in the summer of 1851, 4 years before his death.
The gradually progressing work as a writer, which had its beginning in Either Or, seeks here its definite point of rest at the foot of the altar, where the author, who personally knows best his imperfection and guilt, does not by any means call himself a witness for the truth, only a peculiar sort of poet and thinker, who without authority has nothing new to bring, but would read the fundamental document of the individual human existence, if possible, in a more heartfelt way.
This concludes Knowledge Products, The Giants of Philosophy, Soren Kierkegaard, narrated by Charlton Heston.